of his administrative reforms in the Pentagon, had gained the new president's confidence and began to focus his analytical talents on developing a military strategy to shape and direct the American effort in Vietnam. McNamara would dominate the policymaking process because of three mutually reinforcing factors: the chief's ineffectiveness as an advisory group, Johnson's profound insecurity, and the president's related unwillingness to entertain divergent views on the subject of Vietnam. Above all, President Johnson needed reassurance. He wanted advisors who would tell him what he wanted to hear, who would find solutions even if there were none to be found. Bearers of bad news, or those who expressed views that ran counter to his priorities, would hold little sway. McNamara could sense the president's desires and determined to do all that he could to fulfill them. He would become Lyndon Johnson's oracle for Vietnam. Chapter 4. Graduated Pressure, January to March, 1964. We had seen the gradual application of force applied in the Cuban Missile Crisis and had seen a very successful result. We believe that if the same gradual and restrained application of force were applied in South Vietnam, that one could expect the same result. Cyrus Vance, 1970. Robert S. McNamara and his principal assistants in the Department of Defense, convinced that traditional military conceptions of the use of force were irrelevant to contemporary strategic and political realities, developed courses of action for Vietnam that reflected their experience during the 1962 Cuban Missile Crisis, which molded their thinking on strategy, and their predisposition toward quantitative analysis. In McNamara's concept of graduated pressure, the aim of force was not to impose one's will on the enemy, but to communicate with him. Gradually intensifying military action would convey American resolve and thereby convince an adversary to alter his behavior. Johnson found McNamara's strategic concept particularly attractive because it would not jeopardize his domestic political agenda. Although the presidential election was still 10 months away, he thought that mishandling Vietnam policy might easily cost him victory. He tried to use American involvement in Vietnam to his advantage. He wanted to be seen as a moderate candidate, so he resolved to take only those actions in Vietnam that bolstered that image. The president's deep distrust of his senior military officers manifested itself in exclusive advisory forums that limited JCS access to the president. In those forums, Taylor deliberately misrepresented the Joint Chiefs' opinion and helped McNamara forge a consensus behind a fundamentally flawed strategic concept that permitted deepening American involvement in the war without consideration of its long-term costs and consequences. During the last days of 1963, President Johnson was enjoying a holiday respite at his Texas ranch and pondering the challenges that he would face in the coming year. His deliberations on Vietnam since assuming the presidency had been brief and episodic. He concerned himself primarily with his predecessor's stalled legislative program and his own domestic agenda. On New Year's Eve, however, the president, in a letter to Duong Van Minh, chairman of the South Vietnamese Military Revolutionary Council, emphasized that the South Vietnamese must take primary responsibility for the war. While prodding General Minh to take more vigorous action against the Viet Cong insurgents, Johnson pledged to maintain in Vietnam whatever American personnel and materiel are needed to assist you in achieving victory, and indicated that he was pleased with Minh's plans to intensify the counterinsurgency effort. Johnson's letter exuded hope and optimism. He concluded, As the forces of your government become increasingly capable of dealing with this aggression, American military personnel can be progressively withdrawn. However, Johnson sent a less auspicious telegram to Lodge, in which he called reports of antagonism between the president and the ambassador nonsense, and instructed Lodge to be alert and demanding in telling all of us in Washington how and what more we can do to help. The new commandant of the Marine Corps, Wallace Green, urged his colleagues to provide their commander-in-chief with a comprehensive assessment of the situation in Vietnam. Green was determined to take a more active role than his predecessor, General Shoup, in JCS policy deliberations. He had gained experience in national security affairs as a member of Eisenhower's National Security Council staff. Most important, he did not share Shoup's misgivings about entering a land war in Asia. He soon joined Air Force Chief Curtis LeMay in urging a sharper American military response to North Vietnamese support for the Viet Cong. The chiefs were frustrated because the president's objective in Vietnam seemed ambiguous to them, even though the need to combat communism and win in Vietnam seemed very clear. Meeting on January 8, the JCS agreed on the need to exact a clear commitment from the president and the administration to victory in Vietnam. Without such a clear statement of purpose, they were unsure about what recommendations to make to the Secretary of Defense and the president about the next steps to take in the war. While lacking a clear understanding of the policy objective and an accurate assessment of the military situation, the Joint Chiefs set out to break down restrictions on the use of American military force and gain from the Johnson administration a firm commitment to see the war through to a positive result. On January 22, 1964, the JCS sent McNamara a memorandum on Vietnam and Southeast Asia that referenced National Security Action Memorandum 273 of November 26, 1963. Examined together, the two documents revealed a clear divergence in thinking between the president and his top military advisors. Although the National Security Action Memorandum had affirmed President Johnson's commitment to South Vietnam, it had emphasized that the American objective was to assist the people of that country win their contest against the communist conspiracy. The Joint Chiefs Memorandum, however, listed victory as the unqualified objective of American military force. Accordingly, it recommended that the United States put aside many of the self-imposed restrictions which now limit our efforts and undertake bolder actions which may embody greater risks. The chiefs, arguing that limitations on military operations tend to make the task in Vietnam more complex, more time-consuming, and in the end more costly, recommended that a more aggressive program be approved immediately. That program would include overflights of Laos and Cambodia to acquire operational intelligence, bombing key North Vietnamese targets using U.S. resources and assuming full responsibility for the attacks, and mining the sea approaches to North Vietnam. The Joint Chiefs of Staff argued that the United States was currently fighting the war on the enemy's terms, and warned that the United States would ultimately have to commit its own forces in support of combat action within South Vietnam and in direct actions against North Vietnam. They sought the administration's permission to develop and execute plans designed to achieve outright victory. The administration, however, had decided to commit only those forces necessary to keep South Vietnam from losing the war. Frank communication between the JCS and the president might have permitted a reconciliation of their divergent perspectives and lent coherence to Vietnam planning. The relationship between the commander-in-chief and his principal military advisors, however, did not permit a frank exchange of views. The chiefs and the administration had started down divergent paths. 4 days after the Joint Chiefs sent their memo to McNamara, events in South Vietnam again brought that country to the urgent attention of the U.S. government. On January 30th, at 4 o'clock a.m. Saigon time, tanks and infantrymen of the South Vietnamese Army quickly surrounded the Joint General Staff headquarters and arrested General Big Minh and the key members of his government. South Vietnamese I Corps Commanding General Nguyen Khan, reacting to rumors that members of the Minh government were considering a neutralization agreement with North Vietnam, quickly seized power in a bloodless coup that took the U.S. Embassy completely by surprise. To avoid the embarrassment of having to recognize yet another successful perpetrator of a military coup, President Johnson decided not to acknowledge the change in government. However, Johnson, like Kennedy before him, wanted the South to have a stable government capable of continuing the fight against the Viet Cong. Thus, 1 month after he penned his greeting to General Minh, Johnson drafted a letter to his new partner in the fight against communism, General Khan. He encouraged Khan to intensify military actions against the Viet Cong and renewed his pledge to carry the war to the enemy and to increase the confidence of the Vietnamese people in their government. Ambassador Lodge visited Khan to deliver the president's message and make him understand that he would rise or fall in the eyes of the U.S. depending on his effectiveness in bringing victory. Johnson hoped to get the Vietnamese to fight more effectively and thereby avoid direct American intervention. The Khan coup dashed McGeorge Bundy's hope that after the Diem coup, no issues would divide the administration. Divisions persisted and grew wider as the situation in Vietnam became more precarious. Indeed, the administration was receiving conflicting advice about what to do in Vietnam from numerous sources in Washington and Saigon. Bundy told the president that without improvement in our organization here and in the field, the United States would have difficulty furthering its objectives in Southeast Asia. The conflict between Lodge and Harkins continued and hampered coordination between the embassy staff and the Military Assistance Command. The Defense Department regarded the Office of the Assistant Secretary of State for Far Eastern Affairs, Hilsman, with contempt because it had advocated the Diem coup. Special Assistant to the President for Far Eastern Affairs, Forrestal, recalled that the period was marked by a two-tiered conflict within the Department of Defense and between that department and the State Department. The President met with Bundy, McNamara, and Rusk over lunch on Tuesday, February 4th, to discuss how to organize and better coordinate the government's effort in Vietnam. During the lunch, the subject of replacing Lodge, suggested by Taylor in December, came up. The president and his guests agreed that Lodge was the principal impediment to a smooth-running country team in Saigon. Johnson, however, was reluctant to take the political risk of replacing the man whom John Kennedy had appointed to build bipartisan support for the administration's Vietnam policy. Bundy recommended instead accelerating the replacement of Harkins by Lieutenant General William C. Westmoreland, who was serving as Harkins' deputy at General Taylor's recommendation. Taylor had first encountered Westy in Sicily during World War II. Lieutenant Colonel Westmoreland's confidence while commanding an artillery battalion supporting Taylor's paratroopers inspired the general to record the younger officer's name in his ever-present black notebook. When Taylor became Army Chief of Staff in 1955, he appointed Westmoreland his Secretary of the General Staff. After promotion to Major General, Westmoreland assumed command of the 101st Airborne Division, and in 1960, Taylor used his influence to secure for Westmoreland the superintendency of West Point. In 1963, Taylor, knowing that the President and the Secretary of Defense wanted the perennially optimistic Harkins removed at the earliest opportunity, selected his protege to be Harkins' deputy. McGeorge Bundy also recommended that the President create an ad hoc committee, including representatives from the principal agencies, to study the Vietnam problem, recommend solutions, and build consensus within his administration. The committee would give the president a source of information and analysis free from the infighting that had characterized the debate surrounding the Diem coup and its aftermath. Because the committee would represent all the agencies involved in Vietnam policymaking, the effort would forge unity between different factions within the administration and end the bickering of the past several months. 10 days after the luncheon, the president ordered the formation of a small committee for the management of U.S. policy and operations in South Vietnam. The president rejected Bundy's recommendation that his own man, Forrestal, serve as the committee's chair, and instead named William Sullivan, a career diplomat from the Department of State. Sullivan was a specialist in Far Eastern affairs who had served in Bangkok, Calcutta, and Tokyo. In 1961, he joined Harriman's delegation to the Geneva Conference on Laos. Later, in December 1964, Sullivan would be appointed ambassador to Laos, a post from which he controlled the U.S. secret war to prevent North Vietnam from using that country as a supply route to the South. Forrestal and representatives from the Department of Defense, the CIA, and the Agency for International Development joined Sullivan's committee. The president ordered that department appeal from Mr. Sullivan's decisions shall be kept at a minimum in accordance with the principal purpose of the new council. He hoped that the committee would permit an energetic, unified, and skillful prosecution of the only war we face at present. The chief sensed that the committee would further undercut their influence. 5 days after his appointment, Sullivan met with the Joint Chiefs and LeMay asked him why the committee had been formed. Sullivan emphasized that the president wanted one place to look for accountability and indicated that it would be his neck if American policy failed to keep South Vietnam from falling to the communists, foreshadowing the tight control he would later exercise over military operations in Laos. Sullivan told the chiefs that they did not have a monopoly on the ability to examine military options for Vietnam because no one had yet learned how to prosecute a counterinsurgency. Sullivan informed the JCS that the president had tasked him with considering options ranging from withdrawal to large-scale American intervention in the war. Subsequent comments in the meeting indicated, however, that Sullivan would genuinely explore only those options that included sharply limited military actions against the Viet Cong and North Vietnamese. His mission was not to study the possibility of expanded American military involvement, but to determine what changes in the current mix of military and diplomatic actions were necessary. Taylor warned Sullivan that an advisory effort in the South, coupled with deniable covert actions against North Vietnam, would not hurt the enemy, but he admitted that he had no idea how much more effort would be required. General LeMay was more direct. He told Sullivan that the current policy would result in American involvement over an indefinite period with no light in sight. Sullivan asked the generals how long they thought the United States could sustain the current policy. Taylor replied that the American people would not support it beyond the end of 1965. Sullivan, disagreeing, told the JCS that a military presence in Vietnam did not have to mean heavy forces. The chief's doubts about the current policy and about domestic support for a limited war fell on deaf ears because Johnson had constrained Sullivan to consider one option only, whose consequences he need not explore because he had to support it. Forrestal recalled that Sullivan had already been given instructions to work on options involving the slow, very slow escalation of bombing pressures against North Vietnam. In contrast to the chief's call for increasingly bolder actions, Sullivan's committee developed a program of measured pressures against North Vietnam. The formation of the Sullivan Committee did not quell pressures from within the administration to use American military force to improve the situation in Vietnam. Generals Green and LeMay urged strong military intervention in the war. Green believed that the time had come to either pull out of South Vietnam or stay there and win. He told his colleagues that the Marine Corps position was that victory ought to be pursued with the full concerted power of U.S. resources. Green went on a speaking tour of military staff colleges to persuade others that decisive action aimed at military victory would solve the Vietnam problem. Green was frustrated that the Joint Chiefs had not formed a plan for the conduct of the war and ordered his staff to prepare a series of proposals, the most significant of which was a 24-point plan calling for United States Marine Corps units to secure the coastal areas of South Vietnam in order to deny the Viet Cong access to a large percentage of the population. According to his operations officer, Lieutenant General Henry Buse, it was based on an enclave principle where you establish a bunch of beachheads and protect them. Green felt that America's chances of success in Vietnam would increase proportionally with the introduction of large numbers of Marines. Taylor, who considered Green's plan parochial because it emphasized actions only by Marines, did not forward it to the Secretary of Defense or the President. Calls for more military force in Vietnam were not limited to the Joint Chiefs. Ambassador Lodge sent a cable to the President on February 20th, recommending that various pressures be applied to North Vietnam to cause them to cease and desist from their murderous intrusion into South Vietnam. The President met with Rusk, McNamara, Taylor, McCone, Undersecretary of State Ball, and members of the Sullivan Committee, and instructed them to respond promptly and sympathetically to Lodge's cables to ensure that the ambassador did not become disaffected and entertain notions of public disagreement with the current policy. The President sent Lodge a disarming cable telling the ambassador that he agreed with much of his assessment. LBJ, however, concealed that he was pursuing a course in Washington that contradicted the recommendations of his representative in Saigon. To satisfy the ambassador's enthusiasm to expand American involvement, Johnson ordered that contingency planning be accelerated and decided to send Taylor and McNamara to Saigon in early March. He told Lodge that the men would review the ambassador's recommendations and other aspects of the counterinsurgency campaign and promised that very soon thereafter he would make definite decisions. He was more candid on the telephone with Rusk and McNamara. LBJ told Rusk that Lodge was feeling sorry for himself and he's naturally a martyr. The President wanted the secretary to build a record of support for Lodge to make the ambassador believe that he is Mr. God and has the maximum attention of the government. Johnson told McNamara, "Now I'm thinking politically. I'm not a military strategist, but I think as long as we got him there and he makes recommendations, we act on them. Otherwise," Johnson feared, "we are caught with our britches down." Johnson met with the Joint Chiefs of Staff on March 4th. Green and LeMay told the President pointedly that once the nation embarked on a military course in Vietnam, it must carry it to success, regardless of the cost. They saw only two options in Vietnam, either get in or get out. Johnson, however, was determined not to make a tough decision on Vietnam until after the 1964 presidential election, and Taylor helped him deflect LeMay and Green. LBJ told the JCS, "We haven't got any Congress that will go with us, and we haven't got any mothers that will go with us in the war. I've got to win the election, or Nixon or somebody else has, and then you can make a decision. But in the meantime, let's see if we can't find enough things to do to keep them off base and to stop this shipments that are coming in from Laos and take a few selected targets to upset them a little bit without getting another Korean operation started." Taylor indicated that he too favored progressive, selective air and naval attacks against North Vietnam, and in contrast to Green and LeMay's position, argued that such attacks would not lead to war. Taylor had already revealed his sensitivity to the President's political concerns by drafting a letter for the President's signature to explain reasons for rejecting more resolute military action in Vietnam. Taylor discouraged his colleagues from forcefully voicing their doubts about applying incremental military pressure against the North. He had warned them that their new commander-in-chief does not like split advice. Less than a week before their meeting with the President, Taylor pressed the chiefs to agree on a broad outline for the war. He said they must agree that a strong political base in the South be the first priority and discuss further military action in terms of gradually intensifying phases. Taylor exhorted the chiefs to leave open the issue of incremental attack versus hard blow and advised them to be cautious about advertising air and sea actions alone to avoid charges of parochialism. He held out the prospect of mobilization if the situation in Vietnam worsened. He succeeded in mollifying the JCS before the meeting with the president. McDonald and Wheeler did not support Green and LeMay. And after the meeting with the president, Taylor recorded general agreement with his proposal for measured, gradual action against the North. Despite Taylor's efforts, Johnson remained under pressure from Lodge, the JCS, and the press to clarify his Vietnam policy. The president feared that recent leaks to reporters from the military and members of his administration were making him look like an ass. At the March 4th meeting, he expressed indignation over a recent newspaper article that revealed sentiment within the military for an expansion of the war, and he ordered the JCS to prevent such transgressions in the future. On the same day, Johnson telephoned Walt Rostow, the chairman of the State Department's Policy Planning Committee, about a recent article in which Rostow was quoted. He questioned Rostow's loyalty to the administration and ordered him not to talk to the press at all. LBJ thought the press were anti-Johnson and were making a concerted move to discredit him. He found a sympathetic listener in McNamara. McNamara told the president that the New York Times editorial page was influenced by Zionists who were trying to make him look like a warmonger. The principal purpose of McNamara's forthcoming trip to Saigon would be to alleviate pressure on the president in connection with his Vietnam policy. To keep the JCS and other potential critics at bay, Johnson would need a consensus report. He told McGeorge Bundy that he did not want anybody on this trip to come back with two different plans, and he was particularly concerned about the possibility that McCone might return with a dissenting opinion. LBJ even suggested to McNamara that former Marine Corps Commandant David Shoup join the trip to Saigon to lend additional military credibility to the Defense Secretary's report. Johnson thought that Shoup's Medal of Honor and military record would shield the administration from criticism. The recently retired general could sit in the back room and you don't have to mess with him, but when he gets back here, he can take the McNamara line and sit down and say, "Now, here's the story." Shoup, however, would not make the trip to Saigon. It would be up to McNamara and Taylor to do the president's bidding. Consistent with the principal purpose of his trip, McNamara did not wait for his visit to Saigon to begin conceptualizing recommendations for the future course of America's involvement in Vietnam. He directed his International Security Affairs Division under John McNaughton to develop a draft memorandum to serve as an overall vehicle for thought and a framework for his report on his return. McNaughton and the newly appointed Assistant Secretary of State for Far Eastern Affairs, William P. Bundy, incorporated the findings of the Sullivan Committee and guidance from McNamara into the memo. On March 5th, William Bundy sent the memo to members of McNamara's party. The fact that the report was prepared before the team's visit indicated that neither McNamara nor Johnson intended to learn anything from the trip. In his instructions to the members of the mission, McNamara discouraged interim reports to any department or agency in Washington and forbade sending them without his approval. McNamara hoped that it would be possible for all senior members of the party to concur in all significant points. On March 2nd, the Secretary of Defense met with the Joint Chiefs of Staff to discuss the impending mission to Saigon. McNamara promised the chiefs that he would make a copy of the draft memorandum available to them for comment before it became government policy. He led them to believe that he had not yet taken a position on whether to embark on a course of incremental pressure against the North or to strike North Vietnam with a hard blow. That same day, however, William Bundy was circulating his first draft. which called for planning retaliatory actions on a tit-for-tat basis and for the application of graduated overt military pressure on North Vietnam. 3 days later, Bundy's second draft went to the White House before the chief saw it. President Johnson read it with interest and asked to see it a second time on March 8th, the first day of McNamara's inquiry in Vietnam. The chiefs did not receive a copy of the draft presidential memorandum until after McNamara and Taylor returned from Saigon on March 13th. Traditional military experience mattered little to McNamara, even less in the era of nuclear deterrence and superpower competition. Admiral MacDonald recalled, the defense secretary once said, "Oh, let's stop doing it John Paul Jones's way. Can't you have an original thought for a change?" One of McNamara's assistants told the admiral, "I know you military fellows have always been taught to get in there with both feet and get it over with, but this is a different kind of war." The military's unrealistically sanguine assessments of progress in Vietnam had heightened the defense secretary's doubts about the relevance of military experience to what he regarded as a novel kind of warfare. In keeping with McNamara's views, Taylor told the chiefs on March 2nd that the White House intended to use South Vietnam as a laboratory, not only for this war, but for any insurgency. McNamara became the principal architect of the new strategy of graduated pressure, which he would test in Vietnam. While in his estimation, military experience was irrelevant to the new kind of war, McNamara drew heavily upon his personal experience during the Cuban Missile Crisis. The rejection of JCS advice in October 1962 had led to the withdrawal of the offensive weapons without war. He acknowledged that the missile crisis was very influential in his decisions related to Vietnam. Indeed, U.S. military action against North Vietnam, an analysis, Annex A, to the report that McNamara drafted for the president in early March 1964, contained several direct references to the Cuban Missile Crisis. Although McNamara believed that JCS advice was inapplicable, he thought that the use of American military force was integral to the foreign policy of the Cold War period. He viewed the North's support of the Viet Cong as a manifestation of the Communists' unflagging support for wars of national liberation and as a challenge to U.S. global interests. Similarly, Secretary of State Dean Rusk thought that the administration could not conceivably abandon Vietnam because the United States would lose its prestige in the world. Their assumptions and policies demanded that the United States demonstrate resolve against communist-backed wars of national liberation, but they would ignore JCS advice while planning military action. If the global reputation of the United States and U.S. desire to fight the spread of communism made withdrawal from Vietnam unacceptable, weapons of mass destruction rendered policies that risked escalation to nuclear confrontation unthinkable. McNamara thought that graduated pressure offered a sensible compromise between those two options. He concluded that the principal lesson of the Cuban Missile Crisis was that graduated pressure provided a firebreak between conventional conflict and that situation of low probability but highly adverse consequences that could lead to nuclear war. Rusk, agreeing with McNamara, believed that graduated pressure would never present Peking or Moscow with enough of a change in the situation to require them to make a major decision in terms of intervening in Vietnam. Rusk believed that applying force in carefully controlled gradations would help to limit the war to Vietnam. The reluctance of some of the chiefs to embrace the evolving doctrine of graduated pressure diminished their influence with civilian officials, who adopted the new strategy with an almost religious zeal. LeMay and Green particularly opposed the application of force for any purpose short of victory. Secretary of the Air Force Eugene Zuckert, who had been associated with that service since the early 1940s, recalled that, "On this Vietnam thing, the military, particularly General LeMay, just didn't understand gradualism. LeMay simplified the point: where you had a war, you want to win the war. He never could grasp the subtleties involved, which might make you want to run it a different way. LeMay knew that Taylor advocated the new strategy and lamented the fact that Army Chief of Staff Wheeler, and to some extent, Admiral MacDonald, supported the chairman. To Taylor, graduated pressure may have seemed a logical outgrowth of the flexible response strategy that he and the Army had advocated as an alternative to Eisenhower's strategy of massive retaliation. Both concepts were based on a force structure capable of carrying out military options across all gradations of conflict, whereas flexible response envisioned a clear decision to apply military force at a particular level, graduated pressure involved starting the application of force at a very low level and gradually increasing it in scale and intensity. Whereas the traditional objective of imposing one's will on the enemy still pertained to flexible response, graduated pressure aimed to affect the enemy's calculation of interests. Due to ambiguities in both strategic concepts and to the evolving nature of graduated pressure, however, distinctions between the two were difficult to discern. McNamara deceived the Joint Chiefs of Staff, concealing his position from them until they could neither oppose his recommendations nor offer a cogent alternative. The chiefs were vulnerable to McNamara's tactics because they remained divided on the issue and because the defense secretary could count on delays caused by the cumbersome JCS administrative and decision-making system. McNamara had only the most trusted members of his staff develop strategic options for Vietnam and revealed his position only after he was assured that his view had made it to the president uncontested. Deputy Assistant Secretary Arthur W. Barber of International Security Affairs recalled that his boss, John McNaughton, almost seemed to adopt many of the LBJ manners, hiding his direction, talking with many people, and then popping out with an announcement. To maintain his predominant influence over Johnson, McNamara sent draft memorandums to the president before the Joint Chiefs had an opportunity to comment. During their trip to Saigon from March 8th to 12th, McNamara and Taylor found the Khan government besieged. The level of Viet Cong activity had risen sharply, and the government was losing control of rural areas. The enemy was clearly making the most out of the political turbulence and reduced military effectiveness resulting from the November and January coups, General Taylor recalled. The political structure linking the central government to the provinces had virtually disappeared. 35 of the 41 province chiefs were new appointees, and most of the senior military commands had changed twice since the previous October. The desertion rate in the South Vietnamese forces was high and increasing, while confidence in their ability to provide security was decreasing proportionally throughout the countryside. There was corresponding evidence of a growth of strength on the part of the Viet Cong, derived from local recruiting and added assistance in equipment from North Vietnam. When he returned, McNamara revised his draft presidential memorandum and sent it to the White House. McNamara's memo contained the intellectual foundation for further American involvement in the Vietnam War. He listed alternative courses of action, including direct military action against North Vietnam that could be planned in greater detail during the 8 months before the election in November 1964. He divided future actions into three categories: border control operations, retaliatory actions, and graduated overt military actions by South Vietnamese and U.S. forces against North Vietnam. The military pressure would aim to convince Hanoi to stop supporting the Viet Cong. Border control actions included expanding patrols into Laos and North Vietnam and South Vietnamese air and ground strikes against selected targets in Laos. Retaliatory actions could escalate gradually from reconnaissance flights over North Vietnam to bombing strikes against North Vietnamese targets and mining North Vietnamese ports. McNamara contended that the program of graduated pressure would have to be calculated carefully to minimize the risk of escalation and avoid domestic and international political opposition to widening the war. He recommended against the initiation of overt attacks against the North and urged the president to take only those actions aimed at intensifying the American advisory and assistance effort. McNamara's concept of the use of force appealed to Johnson's desire to avoid deepening American involvement in Vietnam until after the election. On the morning of March 4th, the Joint Chiefs met to discuss the McNamara memo, which they had first received the day before. Green had already commented on it, noting that half measures won't win in South Vietnam. Army Chief of Staff Wheeler stated that the actions included in the memo were inadequate to win the war. Admiral McDonald agreed that the paper did not go far enough and asserted that the United States must take stronger action. He argued that the administration should give immediate approval for hot pursuit of Viet Cong guerrillas into Cambodia, and he called for a more rapid retaliation against North Vietnam in response to Viet Cong actions in South Vietnam. Taylor defended McNamara's provision, allowing 72 hours before retaliation on the grounds that the United States needed to decide what targets were appropriate for a tit-for-tat response. McDonald also suggested that U.S. dependents, family members of military and civilian officials, be withdrawn from Vietnam. Taylor asked McDonald, incredulously, if he wanted to make Saigon look like a war capital. LeMay and McDonald answered emphatically, yes. McDonald observed that Vietnam is an active war area and contended that American forces should set a determined example for their South Vietnamese allies. He concluded that the memo must be strengthened by including options such as hot pursuit, stronger military action in the strategically vital Mekong Delta region, and high and low level aerial reconnaissance of Viet Cong sanctuaries and lines of communication outside South Vietnam. Green agreed with McDonald and again emphasized the need for a comprehensive military estimate of the situation to determine what U.S. military action was required. Green then provided his own estimate, in which he again recommended the introduction of Marines into enclaves in South Vietnam. LeMay agreed with McDonald and Green that the McNamara paper did not go far enough. He discounted McNamara's argument for postponing action against the North until the political situation stabilized in the South, because he doubted that a stable political base in the South was possible without taking overt military action against the North. He argued ardently that the United States should initiate attacks against the North now, and predicted that the American people would be behind strong action. Even the usually unimpassioned Wheeler put Taylor on notice that he would not be a party to proposals suggesting that American objectives in Vietnam could be achieved with mirrors. LeMay, who believed that Taylor and McNamara did not adequately represent the chief's views to the president, wanted a JCS memo that outlined their concerns to go directly to the commander-in-chief. Taylor did not support LeMay's recommendation and kept the JCS position on the McNamara memo from President Johnson. Later that day, Taylor sent a memorandum to the Secretary of Defense that ostensibly represented the JCS commentary on the McNamara memo, but did so only superficially. Taylor hedged the JCS's recommendations in ambiguous language. He stated that the chiefs did not believe that the recommended program will be sufficient to turn the tide against the Viet Cong in South Vietnam without positive action being taken against the Hanoi government at an early date. Although he noted that the chiefs had suggested the kind of action that they had in mind in a prior memo, Taylor left room for a broad interpretation of what the chiefs meant by positive action. He then explained that the chiefs disagreed with the specific recommendations of McNamara's proposal on the issues of hot pursuit and reaction time for retaliatory strikes. Taylor did not mention, however, the chief's reservations concerning the key premises and recommendations of the McNamara paper. He also obscured their general assessment that McNamara's program would not obtain the desired results. McNamara prevented even Taylor's toned-down memo from reaching the president and the National Security Council. On March 17th, the president met with the National Security Council to discuss the McNamara report. Taylor was the only military representative in attendance. Secretary McNamara said that his paper spoke for itself and deferred to his general to present the military actions discussed in the report. Instead of emphasizing the chief's assessment that more resolute military action was necessary, Taylor stressed the risks of escalation posed by even the most limited actions against North Vietnam. He baldly stated that the chiefs supported the McNamara report. According to Taylor, the chiefs mainly criticized the length of the reaction time allowed for retaliatory strikes and recommended changing this from 72 to 24 hours. Admiral MacDonald had actually said that the reaction time should be 3 hours, not 3 days. McNamara interjected that each department and agency concurs with the recommendations which fall in its area of responsibility. The president, evidently pleased with the apparent unanimity behind the paper, said that he understood that even Ambassador Lodge approved the report. Johnson said that the ambassador could be told lies in the area of unfinished business, that is, the ambassador's appeals for direct American military action against North Vietnam, to quell his concerns. To allay the president's worry that Vietnam might become an issue before the election, McNamara reported confidently that no supplemental budget request would be necessary to take the actions outlined in his report. McNamara, like Taylor, feigned sensitivity to JCS concerns by graciously agreeing to have the chiefs study the proposal to reduce the 72-hour delay prior to retaliation. To make sure that he understood McNamara's analysis, President Johnson asked him whether his program would reverse the current trends in South Vietnam. McNamara, disregarding the chief's warning that his program would be insufficient to turn the tide against the Viet Cong, predicted with unqualified confidence that if the government carried out his proposals energetically, the Khan regime could stop the situation from deteriorating further and, within 4 to 6 months, begin to improve it. General Taylor noted weekly that the chiefs believed the proposed program was acceptable, but it may not be sufficient to save the situation in Vietnam. He said the chiefs felt that action against North Vietnam might be necessary to make the program work. In case Taylor's distortion of the chief's position was not sufficient to defuse potential challenges to graduated pressure, McNamara quickly added that Khan was opposed to taking the war to North Vietnam because the South Vietnamese leader's political base was insecure. That was not Khan's genuine feeling, but a concession that McNamara brokered in Saigon to suppress Khan's call for decisive military action against North Vietnam. McNamara was persuasive. Johnson told the men gathered in the cabinet room that they were following the only realistic alternative. The defense secretary's ebullient confidence, untempered by the chief's pessimistic assessment, was contagious. Johnson proclaimed that the McNamara plan would have the maximum effectiveness with the minimum loss. McNamara's strategy of graduated pressure seemed not only to reconcile the administration's need to intervene against communist insurgents with its need to minimize the risk of escalation, but it also reconciled Johnson's desire to get elected with his need to address the difficult situation in South Vietnam. The president concluded the meeting by noting that the McNamara proposal did not rule out further action later if the situation did not improve as we expected. Lyndon Johnson looked around the room and asked whether there were any objections to the McNamara paper. There were none. Meanwhile, top civilian advisors had to rely on rumors to determine what the president's principal military advisors thought about plans for American military intervention in the Vietnam War. While Johnson was meeting with the NSC in the cabinet room, recently promoted Air Force Lieutenant Colonel William Y. Smith, wrote a memo for his boss, McGeorge Bundy, to inform him that the JCS did not support the McNamara plan. After agonizing over whether or not to forward it, Smith concluded that his observations might help avert developments that in the long run could do no one any good. He opened the memo with the following passage. "I believe you will be interested in certain attitudes in the Pentagon concerning Vietnam. These still small but growing undercurrents seem to have been given extra momentum by the McNamara trip report. I'm not supposed to know a lot of this, but here it goes." Smith wrote that he had learned from corridor conversations in the Pentagon that the JCS had become pessimistic about conditions in Vietnam and believed that only strong and forthright action could save the American position. He reported some feeling that the moderate actions proposed by Secretary McNamara do not correspond to the desperate situation the report depicts. Indeed, McDonald made this comment in the chief's March 14th meeting. The chiefs also believed that strong action would not be taken because advisors close to the president, such as Taylor and McNamara, were telling him that he should make decisions based on his chances for re-election rather than the national interest. The chiefs believed that Taylor's and McNamara's loyalty to Johnson prevented them from telling him that only forceful action could influence the situation in South Vietnam. Smith recommended that the administration go out of the way to diffuse any incipient beliefs that Vietnam is becoming a political football, and noted that Lyndon Johnson would be the big loser if it did. After collecting his thoughts on the potential political ramifications of open conflict between the president and the Joint Chiefs, Smith wrote a second memo. He warned that Vietnam could become the missile gap issue of the 64 campaign. In 1960, presidential candidate Kennedy attacked Eisenhower for allowing the Soviet Union to obtain a preponderance of power over the United States in nuclear missiles. The charge was unfounded, as the United States actually possessed an overwhelming superiority in that area. Smith recommended that the president discuss the Vietnam problem with former presidents to give the policy a bipartisan flavor and to ensure that key opinion makers in and out of the administration were on board in support of the administration's policies. Smith warned that finessing a crisis situation for 8 months would be difficult and noted that if the president took forthright action, the public would support his decision. Smith urged the administration to take steps to raise the level of discourse on Vietnam policy above a partisan political preoccupation with the presidential campaign. 2 days later, the president's military assistant, Brigadier General Chester Clifton, corroborated the Joint Chiefs' frustration. Clifton reported to McGeorge Bundy that a usually reliable source had divulged the chief's assessment that the McNamara program fell well short of the minimum level of force needed in Vietnam. Clifton said that Taylor was the only member of the JCS satisfied with the McNamara plan, and he related the chief's opinion that the United States must take action to interdict supply lines connecting the Viet Cong to support from the north. He told Bundy that one of the chiefs had likened the level of force that McNamara supported to that used at the Bay of Pigs. Clifton recommended that if the other chiefs felt the same way, the president should be informed that some military advice would indicate the present plans are insufficient. After reading Smith's memoranda with great interest, Forrestal wrote to McGeorge Bundy to offer additional evidence that the Joint Chiefs were disaffected. He said that Sullivan, when he met with the chiefs in early February, was surprised by the vehemence of opinion in the JCS for strong, overt U.S. action against the North. Sullivan recalled that Admiral McDonald had been particularly adamant, but the other chiefs seemed to support his views. Sullivan told Forrestal that military officers in Military Assistance Command Vietnam and on his own committee had severely criticized McNamara's report. Forrestal suggested that to avert a public dispute with the JCS, the president should avoid too flat an impression that we have stopped thinking about all the possibilities. The administration should emphasize that actions against the North are constantly being reviewed by defense and state to see if further actions need to be taken. If the JCS could be convinced that no important or final decision had been taken, the veneer of continuing consultation and evaluation might forestall open conflict and dissent. Taylor learned about the grumblings that had reached the White House staff. He met with the chiefs on March 20th and asked them pointedly whether they were prepared to go to the Secretary of Defense immediately with more recommendations. He pressed them. What are the chiefs prepared to recommend? Taylor instructed them to bear in mind that the president has said that the in-country program must be solidified before any other actions are taken. The chiefs withdrew from the meeting without deciding to confront directly their differences with McNamara over his plan for Vietnam. Taylor's and McNamara's delaying tactics had worked. Although the chiefs disagreed with McNamara's program, McDonald and Wheeler indicated their reluctance to challenge a policy decision already made at the highest level. Taylor had again suppressed direct opposition to McNamara's policy. This suppression would soon become outright circumvention, and Taylor and McNamara worked together to use the divisions among the chiefs against them. In January 1964, when the chiefs could not reach a consensus over roles and missions for the armed services, Taylor handpicked a group of staff officers from each of the services to prepare a proposal independent from them. When Taylor brought the report up to McNamara's office, the secretary said, "If you say it's good, I'll sign it right now." Taylor told McNamara that several people knew that he had just completed the study and recommended that the defense secretary leave it in his desk drawer for a while to give the impression that he had read it in detail. The roles and missions report did not see the light of day until McNamara signed it weeks later. In March, McNamara took steps to squelch Air Force calls for a new manned bomber. He told LBJ that he was issuing a statement signed by Secretary of the Navy Nitze and Admiral McDonald, claiming that it doesn't make any difference whether the Air Force's missiles or bombers are reliable, that the Navy can win the war alone. LBJ responded, "Won't that start a fight between them?" McNamara, chuckling, replied, "Well, that's what I'd rather like to do. Divide and conquer is a pretty good rule in this situation, and to be frank, I've tried to do that in the last couple of weeks, and it's coming along pretty well." The chief's inability to overcome the service parochialism that had plagued the JCS organization since its inception undercut their legitimacy and made them vulnerable to Taylor's and McNamara's tactics. The administration could not seriously evaluate proposals from a service chief that relied almost exclusively on the resources of his particular service. As has been mentioned, General Green thought that the Marine Corps was ideally suited for occupying Vietnam's seaboard and proposed that it establish secure enclaves along the coast. LeMay remained a zealot for air power. McDonald emphasized mining ports, riverine patrols in the Mekong Delta, and using Navy aircraft to conduct reconnaissance and airstrikes. The exception was General Wheeler, because the Army was larger and more central to defense strategy than it had been under Eisenhower, and because Wheeler owed his position to Taylor, the new Army chief was predisposed to support the administration's policy. Inter-service rivalry also played a prominent role in the considering of key personnel assignments. As they were attempting to provide advice on Vietnam, the chiefs were in the middle of arguing over who should become Westmoreland's chief of staff. LeMay, arguing that the Air Force is not properly represented among the three senior positions in Military Assistance Command Vietnam, strongly recommended that an Air Force officer be assigned the job. Taylor and Wheeler argued that Westmoreland, who preferred Army Major General Richard G. Stilwell, should choose his own man. Anderson and Green agreed on Stilwell, but as a matter of principle, expressed anxiety that Army officers filled the top three military positions in Saigon. McNamara, forced to resolve the squabble, supported Taylor's recommendation that Stilwell get the job. The chiefs had another heated exchange over who would succeed Admiral Felt as Commander-in-Chief Pacific. Pacific Command was the headquarters through which orders and communications flowed between Washington and Military Assistance Command Vietnam. On February 20th, the chiefs ranked the candidate